And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. And a special shout out to ARM FM Armidale, who have recently come on board. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Gordon Bray. Gordon is the author and editor of 6 books on rugby, including the bestseller From the Ruck. He was made a member of the Order of Australia in the Queen's Birthday Honours of 2005 for services to broadcasting as a sports commentator, for the promotion of rugby union football, and to the community. Gordon is an ambassador for Legacy Australia. After his more than 50 years in broadcasting on radio and TV, you know the voice, you know the face, but how well do we know the voice of rugby, Gordon? Welcome to Dads on the Air.
Lovely to be with you, Bill.
So, Gordon, you are synonymous with rugby in this country and perhaps internationally as well. Why is rugby so special to you?
Well, it probably started when I was 7 years of age and my late father took me down to the local rugby club in the western suburbs of Sydney, the Briars Club, and that's where I was first introduced to the game. And I was immediately attracted to the fact that you're playing with mates. And even today, a lot of my mates from school, although I haven't seen some of them for 50 years, we can pick up where we left off. So rugby has special qualities, and it's the amateur ethos I particularly refer to. That's where my involvement was as a player. And outside the professional side of rugby union, those qualities of teamsmanship, mateship, respect, honesty, integrity, and also selflessness, I think, very important. It very much is all about we rather than me. And as a kid, I used to watch the ABC Match of the Day and Cyril Towers and Trevor Allen. And the ABC was a forerunner in sports television and radio. They were the benchmark, and that's how I was attracted. And then I used to mimic my heroes, people like Ken Catchpole from the Ramwick Club. So that's where it all started, and it's been a lifelong love affair, really.
I'd like to go back to 1969, when you were awarded a cadetship with ABC Sport. ABC cadetships seemed to be a pathway for many of our leading journalists. How did you get a start there?
Well, I applied for an ad in the Sydney Morning Herald, and it was totally from left field because I was working as a management trainee with the late Bob Oatley, who was importing coffee beans from Papua New Guinea, and he was going to send me up to PNG straight out of school, basically. But I saw this ad in the Sydney Morning Herald for a specialist trainee, ABC Sport, and I thought, wow, that is my dream job. Acceptable speaking voice, ability to write sporting scripts, the potential to broadcast live sporting events. I thought, wow, that's me, $29 a week. So I applied and went through a rigorous process of audition, and to my amazement, I got the job. Perhaps my involvement with Legacy, I lost my father when I was 9 years of age, and Legacy was very much a father figure for our family. There were 4 kids, 2 boys and 2 girls, and the president of Legacy at the time was Sir Talbot Duckmountain. He was also the general manager of the ABC. So our legatee, Sir Ivan Doggerty, mentioned to Sir Talbot, I'm sure, that I was applying for the job. So I think that got me to the interview stage, and that's all I needed to prove that I was worthy of that specialist traineeship.
Yeah, very fortuitous for us all, I think. Now, you were transferred to Hobart after completing your cadetship. What type of stories did you cover in Tasmania?
Anything from hot air ballooning, rowing, power boats. Even we covered a sail pass, the opening of the yachting season at the Royal Yacht Club of Tasmania. So it was a wonderful learning curve for me. I was thrown into probably 30 or so different sports. We did a different sport every weekend. At one stage there, I was operating the bookies board for our live telecast of the races from Elwick Racecourse.
And one day, a jockey, Jeff Prowse, rode all seven winners on the program, would you believe? And I didn't back one of them. And it was a bit of a disaster because the ABC had forgot to make a videotape booking, so we didn't record any of the races. And this incredible achievement, which would have gone viral globally if it happened today, we had no record of his seven wins. But that was all part of the learning process, I suppose, and was sink or swim. But if you did sink, it wasn't the end of the world. So I had four wonderful years in Hobart, travelling all over the state and also calling Aussie Rules.
I think you have dabbled with both the Mungos, the rugby league boys, and Aussie Rules over the years. But with that broad basis in sport, I guess that did form a good grounding for when you went to the Commonwealth Games in Christchurch.
Well, that was probably my big break, I've got to say. I was based in Hobart, and the ABC decided they were going to send a young commentator as part of the broadcast team to join all of these legendary, iconic commentators in the ABC sports department from all over Australia. And there were two young guys, and it happened that both of them came from Hobart. The other guy, Graham McNaney, was actually selected ahead of me. So I was devastated. You know, I wished him well, and he invited me to his farewell barbecue the night before he departed for Sydney. And I promise you, Bill, this is a true story. He was cooking my steak on his barbecue, and a brick fell off the barbecue onto his big toe. Now, you could say, fortunate for me, he was only wearing thongs, and he broke his big toe. So we rushed him to hospital, but yeah, he was unfit to travel. So that's how I got my big break, literally. And there I was in Christchurch, 1974 Commonwealth Games, sharing a room with the late Dick Mason, who was a big, boisterous commentator, called a spade a shovel. I remember at the 1984 Los Angeles Olympics, he was calling women's basketball, and he was getting very upset with the officialdom. And he made the comment that this referee is either a cheat or is incompetent. And I suspect it's the latter.
With all those sports, what would you say is the hardest sport you've had to commentate?
Taekwondo. I did taekwondo with Lauren Burns at an Olympic Games. That was difficult, but that was interesting because one of the competitors actually attacked the referee. Hadn't seen that before. He wasn't happy with the decision, so he actually assaulted the referee, so he was disqualified for life. But maybe the most difficult broadcast assignment I've had was at the Hong Kong Sevens, and it was my first year there back in the early 80s, and I was calling with Ian Robertson from the BBC, and we were doing an international coverage, and the ABC was also covering it. And the first match was Taiwan versus Bahrain. And Ian Robinson, who'd been calling the sevens for quite a few years, said, look, I'll call the first half, you can do the second, just to ease you in to the assignment. And anyway, we saw the players run out on the field, and the Chinese Taipei side actually all looked the same. They had crew cuts, and they had no numbers on their backs. What a nightmare. And I'm looking at Ian Robinson, and he's chatting away. And then Bahrain came out, and guess what? They had numbers on their backs, but they were Arabic numbers. So I had no idea what was going on. And then Ian Robertson, God bless him, slipped a little note under my nose while I was talking and said, Gordon, dear boy, I need to duck out to the gents. And that's the last I saw of him. He left me to call the game. It was funny at the end, the director came through and said, Gordon, that was amazing. How did you know all those names? And I said, look, it's just preparation. In fact, I just called names randomly. I had no idea who was who. But anyway, the director was, he was impressed. I don't know what they thought in Taipei or Bahrain, because it bore absolutely no resemblance to what was happening.
Well, now, just going back to your arrival in the Sydney studios of the ABC, you mixed with some legendary characters that must have had an effect on you as a primordial sports commentator. Who are some of those you remember?
Well, the first day I walked into the ABC sports offices at 164 William Street, I'll never forget it. I was greeted by the sporting coordinator, Bert Oliver. He was the voice of the Sydney Hobart, covered all the yachting for the ABC, and he introduced me to the various people inside the sports department. The first office, we opened the door, and there was my great hero, Alan McGilvray, Mr. McGilvray, and sharing the office with him was Jeff Marney, the race caller. Jeff was the race broadcaster. Now, McGilvray was a very traditional person. He'd arrive with his hat, his suit, and a beautifully white starched shirt and tie. Jeff Marney was a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde character. He had a magnificent, booming voice. I call it his ABC voice. But away from the microphone, it was, ah, g'day, mate, how are you? Yeah, lovely to see you. And I remember one day at the races, he's talking on air, yes, the fillies are now moving out on the course for the first Barara graduation. And number one, how's that? He's heavily bandaged on the near hind. So that's the way he spoke. But then when you'd hear him off air, he used to have the racecourse touts in the box with him. Curly the Caterpillar, Tommy Tomato, Freddy the Flea. And Jeff would be going through the horses with his binoculars before we would cross to him. And one day Freddy the Flea said, Jeff, why does the AJC hold these races so late? And I actually crossed to Jeff while he was answering that question. So we got half of his answer, which was because the bloody AJC wouldn't know what bloody day it was, Fred. And we got half of that on air. And then someone yelled, Jeff, you're on! And of course, bang, he flicked the switch. And there was that beautiful, yes, now the Colts and Geldings are just about set here at Royal Randwick. So, yeah, great characters. Martin Royal, the voice of soccer, was in the next office. Alan Marks, who called rugby league on television and became the coordinator for ABC's magnificent radio coverage of the Olympic Games. John O'Reilly, formerly of Young. Beautiful dulcet tones of John O'Reilly as a rugby league caller. And then, of course, Norman May, the great Nugget May. And I'll never forget being introduced to Norman. He was sitting at his desk, as he did, looking straight out the window. The desk was totally clear. And he'd do the crossword when he came in, and then he'd just look out the window until it was about midday, when he, McGilvray and Marnie would head down to the Strand Hotel for their daily liquid beverage at lunchtime. But I remember Norman May said, hello, hey Gordo, when are we going to the pub? First thing he said. And Bert Oliver said, look, Norman, I don't think that's setting a very good example. And he said, yep, no problem, no problem. Anyway, he invited me to the 729 Club the first Saturday I was there. And there he was sitting in the 729 Club. And I thought, wow, what a wonderful opportunity to meet this incredible broadcaster. He was the benchmark for sports commentating in Australia. And there he was with his form guide of the Wentworth Park Greyhounds, his little transistor, and he was betting on the Greyhounds. And he said, ah, Gordo, how are you? You got your pay packet? And I said, oh, Mr. May, yes, I have, actually. All $29, less tax. And he said, give it to me. We'll put it through the pokies. I'll double it for you. So very reluctantly, I gave him my pay packet, and within 10 minutes, it was gone. And that was my, I promise you, that was my rent and my food for the week. So I don't know how I survived that one, but yeah, no, amazing characters and very fond memories.
We've reached the part of the show where we ask our guests to pick a song. Gordon, have you got a song for us?
I have, and the background to this is that when I was still in late high school years, I used to go to fellowship class on a Friday night at Strathfield with a few mates, and afterwards, a couple of times, I went up to Redmire Road at Strathfield. Why? Because that's where the Bee Gees were living, Barry Gibb, Morris and Robin, and I was a great fan of the Bee Gees. They were an incredible group, and therefore, I would, with mates, throw rocks on the roof of the Bee Gees' house just to make Barry Gibb come out and see what was going on, and he did a couple of times. In fact, one time he chased us down the street back towards the boulevard in Strathfield. We ran for our lives. We were too fast for him. But yeah, going back to the Bee Gees, my song is Immortality, and this was the version by Celine Dion, a beautiful woman, exquisite voice, and it was her tribute, the Grammy tribute to the Bee Gees, and she performed Immortality, and it was all about her journey through eternity and remembering loved ones that had passed. So Celine Dion, tribute to the Bee Gees, Immortality.
Now we come to a magical moment in the whole proceedings. We'd like to bring on our guest star. Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Celine Dion.
That was Immortality, sung by Celine Dion, and that was specially chosen for us today by our guest, Gordon Bray. So, Gordon, we were just talking about Norman May, who is famous for his gold, gold, gold call of the men's 4x100 men's relay final in the 1980 Olympics. But the other notable event that year was when Norman handed over to you the role of rugby commentator at the ABC. How did you feel at that moment?
Well, I was absolutely pinching myself. I'd been calling rugby league on radio in the late 70s, and I'd always followed rugby league. I played rugby league in primary school. That's where young kids learnt to tackle, but when I got to high school, it was all rugby. But I did love my rugby league, and I think even young rugby players today still watch the rugby league and follow the rugby league. So that's why it's so important that we get, and we now have, rugby union on free-to-air television through the Nine network with the Super Rugby and the Test matches. But I was given the choice to call rugby league on television or rugby union on television at the start of 1980, and I knew where my heart was, and for me it was a no-brainer. I went for rugby union, and what a start it was. Norman anointed me as his replacement, so I was thrilled about that. And I actually called the Bledisloe Cup Series against New Zealand in 1980. And into the scene, onto the stage, came the likes of Mark Eller, Michael Hawker, Michael O'Connor. We also had great players like Roger Gould and Peter Grigg. So all these wonderful young backs who'd been in the schoolboy team, the Ellers, the Hawkers, O'Connors of 77-78, they were known as the Invincibles, and they ran riot against New Zealand. It was amazing. And there I was calling my first Test series and Australia giving the All Blacks a hiding. It doesn't happen too often, no. But it was a dream debut.
Well, your own background, it's not the recognised route in rugby circles. You're not from a private school in the eastern suburbs, and you actually represented combined high schools back in the day. So as a player, so was rugby a big part of your life even then?
It was. Obviously, after I lost my father, that was a massive blow to the family, and times got very tough. My mother was a housewife. We were trying to keep some of the family businesses alive, but she was not a businesswoman. She became very sick. So rugby and cricket were my outlets. And then through high school years, I went to that very famous Western Suburbs Finishing Academy, Homebush Boys High, and it was a selective high school, made some fantastic mates there. John Coates was in my class. We shared free periods, actually, the Australian Olympic boss, and we even ducked out to Canterbury races during our free periods where applicable. All very legal, of course, when we were senior boys. And, 1965, when I was in year 10, we won the Waratah Shield, which is the statewide competition. And the linchpin of our forward pack was Aussie John Simon, Aussie Homelands, who's been very successful. And his mother and father used to supply the oranges for us at half time because they had a greengrocer shop at Strathfield Station. So there you go. Yeah, rugby has been my journey, and to be able to spend 50 years of broadcasting calling rugby. In fact, my first international match was in the early 70s in Hobart when Tasmania played France. And Tasmania scored the first try, would you believe? Length of the field intercept, yeah. And my expert commentator, George Debnam, who was the local dentist, spat out his false teeth. And we're up the top of the ABC scaffold, so he had to scramble down the ladder and try and find his teeth so that he could resume the commentary. Oh, my goodness.
Well, you've certainly learned how to cover when odd things happen on air, by the sound of just a few of them. But then, after 25 years at the ABC, you went to the commercial stations. Now, was this a selling of your soul? I mean, what was behind that move?
Well, after the ABC lost Test rugby in 1991, the last game I'd called for the ABC, last Test match the ABC's called, was the World Cup final, Australia's win over England at Twickenham. So certainly we went out on a high. I was approached by Channel 10, who were the new commercial broadcast partner for Rugby Australia, but they didn't pursue it, and so I was on the sidelines until 1994 and covering all sorts of, I guess, Tier 2 sports like volleyball and lawn bowls. There wasn't a lot there for ABC television sport, so that was quite frustrating. I did come up with some initiative. For instance, I convinced the Irish Tourist Board that we should make a television special called Swinging Through Ireland, visiting famous golf courses in Ireland. The ABC backed me on that. So we took Mark Taylor, the Aussie cricket captain. He was there playing a famous course, Royal County Down in Northern Ireland. Edwina Kennedy, the Irish Tourist Board, flew her over, and she played at Royal Port Rush, which is a brilliant Lynx course in Ireland. And we made this special. So I really had to compromise my situation and come up with different avenues and different opportunities. Mm. And my plan was to do Swinging Through France, Swinging Through New Zealand, Swinging Through Malaysia, and approaching the tourist boards. But then the opportunity came in 94 to join Channel 10. So again, there was no decision to be made there. You had to take it. I wasn't selling my soul, although I must say the financial compensation was significantly more than my ABC, my modest ABC salary. But it really was about following my love of rugby union. And Channel 10 gave me that opportunity, even though I was there for only 1 year, because Channel 7 then bought the rugby in 1995, and they approached me, and I had to go through the New South Wales Supreme Court because I was sued by 10 for breach of contract. Mm. But fortunately, we won the case, and I was able to go to Channel 7, and I was there for 11 or 12 years.
Mm. So there have been a few turning points, haven't there, in your career? Any that we haven't mentioned?
The turning point was clearly that big break, the barbecue in Hobart, and then the opportunity to call rugby in 1980 when the great Norman May retired. But really, I think it's all about never saying no to any opportunity. And I've always adopted the attitude that when I joined as a specialist trainee, there was no substitute for hard work. So I actually went out on a Sunday in my own time with a tape recorder and did a practice call of the rugby league games at the Sydney Sports Ground. And then I would bring those back on the Monday morning to John O'Reilly, and he would have a listen. I actually brought the first one back to Norman May, and he said, when you've done 25 more, come back and see me. So it wasn't easy, but that was a turning point in itself, that I realised I couldn't take anything for granted. I had to really treasure the opportunity I had, and I just went full bore, 150% all the time, to really establish myself, because, as I say, times had been tough at home. Our family had really struggled financially, and this was my opportunity to really seize the moment and also help my mother, who was really struggling at the time.
1991, after Australia won the World Cup, rugby was on an absolute high. Seems like we're now at another crisis point. What do you think they should do?
Well, I think things have been in a bit of a void, really, for the last decade or so. Look, there's a whole host of reasons, but importantly now, on a positive side, rugby has one media partner, not a separate free-to-air partner. You've got Nine and Stan, and The pay-per-view and the free-to-air are all part of the one family. And I think that's very important. And we're now getting some continuity with Super Rugby, which is on free-to-air, one match a week on the Nine Network. And that marries in with the coverage on Stan of the other Super Rugby games. So that's very important. But I think rugby's also got to recognise the young kids playing. Just as I was attracted to the game and it became a lifelong love affair, it's now about getting back to the grassroots and really pouring money into those areas like the other football codes have, particularly Aussie Rules, have done exceptionally well and found them their way into the GPS schools in Sydney and also in Brisbane. But really linking now the kids, getting them excited about the Wallabies and also their provincial teams, and driving that grassroots force up to the summit, if you like. So that's the big challenge now for Australian rugby, but I'm convinced it can be done.
Well, there you have it in a nutshell. And what about you, Gordon? And I don't think we're going to get the pleasure of hearing your voice on Stan and Channel 9. So what are you looking at in the future?
I never say never. I did have a coffee with the boss of Nine and Stan Rugby, and that was very decent of him to have a chat and hear me out. When you're dropped from the main team, you've got to roll your sleeves up, haven't you, and just keep going. So whilst I won't be calling rugby matches for the moment, I certainly haven't given up the hope of returning and calling test match rugby and even provincial rugby and even club rugby and even schoolboy rugby. So it's all about, for me now, giving back. I'm mentoring a couple of young international girls, Alicia Quirk, Alicia Lucas, now married, as a commentator, and also Emily Chancellor, who's a Wallaroo from Sydney University, and they're progressing brilliantly. A lot of young commentators, budding commentators, come to me for advice, so I'm very happy to help them. And I'm helping a young guy who's come up with the idea of doing a podcast for the Melbourne Rebels. His name is Oscar Jaeger. We are doing a co-hosting a podcast for the Melbourne Rebels, and so that's quite an interesting and exciting journey, and it's a labour of love, I've got to say, but it's all about helping younger people. So I'll never retire. I'm full of beans and enthusiasm and passion, and it's been an amazing journey, and I'm quite convinced the best is yet to come.
Let's hope so. I think we're all on your side. Would be great to hear you continuing with the rugby calls, which we've grown up with. Unfortunately, we could go on chatting rugby stories all day, I'm absolutely sure, but we've run out of time today, so I'd just like to give a very special thank you to Gordon. Gordon, thank you very much for coming to the studio and speaking to us today.
Yes, Bill. Well, we met at a luncheon, didn't we, of old media people, and you came up with a suggestion, and here we are. So I really am grateful for the opportunity to spend time with you at Fine Music, and I think it's a wonderful operation, all run by volunteers, and that's what it's all about, giving back.
Thank you, Gordon. And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to your favourite podcast app or our website, dadsontheair.com.au. Or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.